Well, back for a semi-annual visit to discuss climate-related developments and concerns is a good friend, Dr. Jeff Andreessen. Jeff is the state climatologist for Michigan and a professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, it's always good to catch up on climatological matters, especially this year with so much going on.
It's great to be back, and as usual, there's plenty to talk about.
Well, let's talk about, on this program in the past, we've talked about El Nino and La Nina. There's been a lot in the news. Explain to our listeners what these phenomena actually are.
Right. Well, El Nino is a nickname of a two-phase phenomenon, and it's a combined circulation pattern both in the atmosphere and in the oceans. And it's concentrated in the equatorial Pacific region of the world, and it's part of something larger called the El Nino Southern Oscillation, ENSO or ENSO for short, and El Nino is the warm or negative phase of ENSO, and then La Nina is the nickname for the cool or the positive phase. And the warm and cool refer to ocean or sea surface temperature anomalies that are either significantly below or above long-term normals. And we've just been through, depending on how it is defined, but it's certainly one of the strongest El Nino events of the last century here. It began last summer. It took it a while to get going, but once it did, it was a big event globally. And why it matters to us, something in the equatorial Pacific, many people always ask, well, that's thousands of miles away, and it's true. But the issue is that El Nino and La Nina, these two phases, are associated with very unusual, sometimes almost reversals of normal sea or ocean current patterns and atmospheric patterns as well. And ultimately, many of these patterns influence the pattern or flow of the jet stream around both hemispheres, both the north and south. And of course, for us here in the Midwest and in temperate areas around the world, the jet stream is the primary controlling factor for our day-to-day and week-to-week weather. So if there's something that influences that in the Pacific, it matters to us. And what we see typically, we find certain types of weather patterns that are associated with El Nino. It tends to, both of these things, El Nino and La Nina, tend to happen during the Northern Hemisphere winter and spring months. And not always, but more often than not, they do. And when we do have El Ninos at this time of the year, typically our winters across the Midwest and much of the northern U.S. Tend to be milder than normal. And within the Great Lakes region, they also tend to be drier than normal, statistically. Not all of them, but more often than not. So that's why it's important. ENSO, or El Nino Southern Oscillation, turns out to be the most important tool in the long lead outlook prediction business that there is, and it hasn't been known about for that long, but it's a very, very important component of global climate. And again, it allows meteorologists and climatologists to look out beyond more than a few days or a few weeks. We can actually look out at months in advance. And in some parts of the world, notably the Pacific Rim and low latitude areas, it's highly, highly correlated with weather patterns there, and more strongly than it is here. But it's a huge, it's a global phenomenon, and that's why it gets so much publicity. It had the weather patterns with that lead to, well, droughts, famines, all sorts of problems, but also to positive weather anomalies as well. So it's a big deal, and it influences us here, even thousands of miles away.
Even though El Nino is fading, and some say, I think you said, stick a fork in it,
right.
And La Nina is emerging, but we did have a milder winter here in Michigan this year, and then we've got quite a bit of dryness. Those are typically associated with El Nino.
We did, but we had here in Michigan, that we look overall for the state collectively. Our winter mean temperatures were 7.5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. That's way up there. That's the fifth warmest winter on record. So certainly in that regard, it was very, very El Nino-like, the winter. However, more often than not, our winters are also dry, but ours, of course, was not. We had wetter than normal conditions during the winter, and also we had a warm and wet spring as well, although not to the same extent. So a reminder that not all of those events are the same, at least the impacts, but it has been unusually warm, and that certainly follows the vast majority of El Nino events are mild, and that was certainly the case now. But yes, to your last comment, it has left, even with the wetter than normal winter, because of dryness since early and middle May, we've turned the other direction really, really, really quickly.
My guest is Dr. Jeff Andreessen. We're talking El Nino and La Nina. He's the state climatologist for Michigan, professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Well, we're talking about weather in Michigan here, Jeff. You just talked a little bit about our spring. As we're moving into summer now and into the fall, what's the outlook in the Great Lakes region?
Well, I would love to say, at least as we're speaking, I'd love to say that it was one with more precipitation. We really are in need of water in many parts of the state. Not all, but more and more each day, because we have been trending drier than normal over roughly the last 4 to 6 weeks. And unfortunately, we're at a time of the year when the water needs, both for agricultural crops, but also for natural vegetation, are reaching their peaks seasonally. We need a lot of water at this time of the year, so that's not a favorable trend. And we've missed out on a lot of rainfall that's fallen in other parts of the region. So right now, parts of southern and eastern Michigan are among some of the driest parts of the Midwest. But that said, the outlook here for at least for the next few weeks suggests unfortunately, a little bit more of the same. Temperatures probably coming out a little bit above normal levels, and precip. Well, we'd be lucky, I think, if we were hitting normal, but it probably, unfortunately, will remain below normal levels. Now, the long lead outlook for the remainder of the summer itself has been consistent in calling for warmer than normal mean temperatures. That's been in our forecast for a while. Precipitation-wise, though, there's no direction. There isn't a piece of the forecasting guidance that really says stay drier or that we'll turn wetter. Right now, it's considered officially equal odds of below, near, and above normal. That's also been the case now for a few months. So, and that's not so bad, but we have to remember that if it does indeed turn out to be warmer than normal, then the needs for water will be greater than they typically are. Warmer air holds more moisture, more water vapor, and so those crop water needs and vegetation water needs will be larger as well. So irrigation has already become important in this particular year, but hopefully we'll get some help from Mother Nature with some natural rainfall here soon.
Well, you anticipated with irrigation, but we had the wet spring and a fairly wet winter, so the groundwater reserves are probably okay right now.
That's right.
But the irrigation will draw those down
fairly
quickly. And
that's a very, very good point. We have come out of other winters that were much drier, and we'll use 2012 as an example of that, where we came out of a very, very mild winter, but it was also drier than normal, and the reserves in the soil, which may be, depends greatly on soil type, from as little as maybe 3 inches in the top 3 feet or so for a very sandy soil to as much as maybe 7 or 8 inches in a heavy clay-based soil that are all available to plants. It's a very, very important part of how they operate during the warm season. We're relying on those reserves heavily right now. One of the problems, of course, is that plants or crops that were planted may not have the roots to take advantage. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There still is moisture
because
in the
ground.
Because
the root development hasn't occurred because of the lack
right.
of...
That's right. Or again, there's a number of issues with planting into dry conditions like that. Yeah. But there is water there, and that hopefully will help for later on in the season if it does continue to be dry.
I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist for Michigan. I'd like to get into the something we always talk about this time of the year, our lake levels. Mm. How are they and in general, and what's the outlook as we move again into the summer and the fall?
Lake levels, as most people probably appreciate if you've been there, have changed dramatically, and that's an understatement over the last couple of years, but they're significantly above our long-term normals. But saying that, we don't have to go back too far. Less than 2 years, in some cases, we were near record low levels. So the change that we have observed here, really since the winter of 2013-14, has been nothing short of incredible, almost record-breaking. It's been one of the most rapid increases in lake levels that we've seen historically.
In fact, some people are even beginning to worry. The same people who worried about whether they're ever going to get their boats back in the water are now concerned about whether the water's going to come up into their cottages.
I was just going to bring that up. It's amazing how things change if you give them time. But I've heard many comments from folks about, oh, we had so much beach just a year and a half ago, but now not so much. And it's part of the natural variability of our system. Most of the change that we've seen can be attributed to increased precip in the basin, of course, the supply of water into the lake system itself. The other part of it that most people don't think about, though, is we had two very severe winters in 2012-13 and 2013-14. In which there was a great deal of ice cover on the lakes. Mm-hmm. And that ice inhibits, or in some cases prohibits, evaporation and loss of water. So there's a balance there. Both of those, though, combined with so much ice on the lakes with above normal precipitation to really, really change things quickly. We had been, prior to that, back at the beginning of 2013, our lakes had been at below normal levels for several years,
right.
Unusually low levels. And in the case of Superior and Michigan, near record low levels. So we've just had an amazing turn or change in a short period of time.
One of the problems, as you well know, in Lake Erie is the depth of that, because and that helps. That's one of the factors that's conducive to those algal blooms that form in Lake Erie. Are those levels going up as well? Lake Erie is just by nature, in and of itself, shallower than the other lakes, right?
That's right. It behaves a little bit differently, especially in the winter. It's the first one to freeze over because of its depth, and again, it just behaves a little bit differently than a lake, say, like Superior, where you've got much more volume of water, and it's more complex, mm-hmm. What goes on there, the depth and so forth. So the biology and ecology is a bit different as well. But all the lakes, at least the upper lakes, have recovered pretty significantly since, especially though, Superior and Michigan.
And, of course, this is a little bit aside that comment, but all the research that's being done in the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes restoration and the attention that the mayors and agriculture are paying to our crown jewel, really, is got to be good news to a climatologist, but it's got to be good news for society in general.
It is, and I think it's a reminder. It's one of the most valuable resources that we have. And unfortunately, it's like everything, there are limitations, and we have to remember that, and it has to be protected. And it's encouraging to see that there are rules and such in effect that do look at the long-term sustainable outcome that we all probably want and need.
Jeff, let's turn to a topic that's much more problematic, and that's carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. We're moving north. We're over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide now. Climate patterns and carbon dioxide concentrations, is there a relationship?
There is. It's a very, very strong relationship. And we know over geologic timeframes in Earth's history that when we have had high carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as well, such as methane, when those concentrations in the atmosphere have been high, so have air temperatures at the same time. And where it starts to become a bit more complicated is what precedes what or what begets what. And we've seen both ways. But we know without question there's a very, very strong correlation between the concentrations of these gases and our surface temperature. And the climate has varied dramatically. Of course, we in Michigan here from tropical to glacial and everything in between, just as an example of that. But as you mentioned at the beginning, the rise in concentrations now beyond 400 parts per million are a real concern and are very likely associated with some of the increase in temperature that's been observed globally here, certainly over the last 1 to 2 centuries. And basically past the or from the end of or beginning of the Industrial Revolution up to the present, the very, very rapid increase in emissions of these gases. But we also have warming, and there's been some news globally that I think is certainly important, and We have set a number of new all-time records for global temperature that are worth noting. And one of them is just, we've set an all-time new global high temperature for the warmest, and that's combined land and ocean temperatures on our record. That essentially goes back about a century and a half, but it's still noteworthy, and it's still an indicator that our global temperatures are continuing to increase and again have reached new highs. A couple of the other ones, though, virtually all of the highest temperatures have occurred within the last 20 years, and some that are eye-openers. 13 of the greatest 15 monthly departures from normal on the positive side have all occurred in the last 15 months, including that highest temperature on record, which was set earlier this spring. And associated with that, of course, we have near record low levels of sea ice and rates of melting as well. Those are all correlated. One other one that's worth noting too, I think, is that it's not only our conventional observing network, which is thermometers or temperature sensing devices around the world. That's been our conventional one. There's also another set of data taken from satellite,
right,
that looks down on the Earth and basically can sample every square mile or foot, as it were, and very, very accurate. The problem, of course, is it's much shorter in duration. It only goes back to the 1970s. But this particular record, it measures temperatures in roughly the lowest 5 miles of the atmosphere. So it's not the same thing as what our conventional network does, but it's still looking at the lower part of the troposphere, the lowest major layer of the atmosphere. And it has risen over time, but it hasn't behaved quite like the surface series that I mentioned before. And that was listed as a concern in terms of what's going to happen or what's happening. That has recently also set all-time new records. So the comment was that this particular satellite record is not increasing. So there's something wrong here, something that's not adding up. That's no longer the case. That record is also showing.
That's becoming more consistent with the.
It is, and again, it isn't the same thing. That's the most important thing to note. But it also has recently reached new record levels. Now, that said, an important caveat is that some of this, the record high temperatures that we've observed here over the last year, are associated with El Nino. Remember, warmer than normal sea surface temperatures over thousands of miles of the equatorial Pacific. That's part of it. There also, interestingly, are record warm temperatures in much of the Indian Ocean basin at the same time. But collectively, much of the world, not all, but most of the world is at or near record warm values right now. But these oceans, which cover, of course, 70% of the globe, when they're that warm, the averages all show positive or all show large deviations from normal. And so El Nino is part of it, but it's still a longer term trend.
For those who would suggest that this can all be attributed to normal or historic climate patterns as opposed to human activity, what would you say?
There's a growing research, lots of research to suggest that is not the case, that the warming of the last century and a half just can't be explained by the atmospheric noise alone. And there's quite a bit to support that. At least some of it is we have to look at the greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's the only real explanation.
Well, on that note, it's been a pleasure, as always, to talk with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist from Michigan and professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, I hope we get some rain here in the next few weeks.
you,
I know you do
you
as
and
well.
I both. But yeah.
Thanks so much for being a guest on Greening the
Great Lakes. It's my pleasure. Thank you.